Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The city of Portland, Oregon has been an extremely volatile stage for much street carnage these past few months. Most ominously, when secret police were sent by Donald Trump to ostensibly quell protests, which in reality, as a result of official violence, flared them volcanically. Last week, right and left-wing groups clashed in front of the federal courthouse in Portland, which has happened quite a few times in the city since Trump became president. This brings to mind a magazine panel cartoon of several years ago of fierce opposing crowds in street battles. One group carrying signs that proclaimed, "People against for," and the other side, "People for against." Today's program centers on an earlier Portland protest 50 years ago this next week against the Vietnam War, and afterward, the origin in Portland of an even earlier protest movement, the Bonus Army of the 1930s. I begin with the People's Army Jamboree, which I wrote. 50 years ago, in late August 1970, an anti-Vietnam War protest against the American Legion at its annual convention, which was held that year in Portland, Oregon, both galvanized and polarized the city and state. Vietnam Veterans Against the War essentially spearheaded the Legion protest, but were actually only a small part of an amalgamation of Northwest anti-war groups and individuals that became involved. A gaudy hodgepodge of war resistors, idealists, and malcontents who mirthfully self-named their protest the People's Army Jamboree. Right alongside was formed an alternative countercultural rock festival that was named Vortex One, designed to draw off expected masses of anti-war activists and essentially provide a non-provocative celebration of flower power. Lewis and Clark history professor Dory Hilton, who had earlier written about the anti-Vietnam War student strike at Portland State University that occurred in the spring that year, wrote that in July 1970, Oregon Governor Tom McCall was informed by the FBI that 50,000 anti-war protesters were planning to descend upon Portland to disrupt the National American Legion Convention, and would be hell-bent on destruction and other atrocities were in store. Historian Hilton wrote that McCall signed on to a plan by the family, a group of hippies who suggested a Woodstock-type rock festival to draw protesters away from Portland, thus averting expected violence, which would be the first government-sanctioned countercultural event. Portland was abuzz with separate encampments, Hilton wrote. The People's Army Jamboree, the American Legionnaires, city and state police, the Oregon National Guard, the FBI, CIA, Secret Service, the Portland Mayor's Men, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Men, the Governor's Men, the President's Men, Richard Nixon was to be a guest of the Legion, the family whose brainchild was Vortex One, people for Portland, ordinary citizens who acted as buffers between potential combatants along parade routes, Vietnam veterans for and against the war, inside and outside agitators, mostly police plants, and frightened, bemused, outraged citizens, not in our town. That was the scene in Portland during the late summer of 1970, Professor Hilton wrote. But a funny thing happened on the way to the confrontation. The separate, disparate encampments began to communicate with one another. Whatever their differences regarding the Vietnam War, she wrote, they all agreed on one thing. Nonviolence was the only violence they wanted to experience on their streets. No Kent State would visit Oregon. While their right to dissent would be supported, only nonviolent forms of dissent would be allowed, the government, and citizen troops adopted rules of mediation in the confrontation situation about to occur before the American Legion and the People's Army Jamboree, Professor Hilton wrote. For all the elaborate preparation for the careful attention to open lines of communication among all groups involved, in the end, perhaps 1,200 people marched with the People's Army Jamboree through the streets of Portland, and the American Legionnaires held their parades without incident, save from taunting from the sidelines, Dory Hilton wrote. When it was all over, the city of Portland had suffered one broken window, she wrote. The rest of this account is from a personal recollection. Professor Hilton asked me to write about the People's Army Jamboree. The first time I heard about the American Legion's plan to hold its annual convention in Portland in the summer of 1970 was the previous December, when a reporter for the now defunct Oregon Journal, a Vietnam veteran, told me the Legion was coming and suggested something ought to be done to confront their unconditional support of the Vietnam War. By then, I had been a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War from nearly its inception a couple of years earlier, and after helping recruit dissident veterans all over the USA, I was VVAW's Oregon organizer. The veteran reporter said the most logical opposition to the American Legion would be Vietnam veterans. He said it would be a momentous opportunity for Vietnam veterans to directly challenge Pentagon war policies through the American Legion, which rubber-stamped every military ambition and pretension. Vietnam veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them felt they had been betrayed by honor, duty, country, which made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. For most disaffected veterans of the war, it was either sympathy for Vietnamese and remorse for the savage destruction of their country by American arms, or antipathy toward the war from the point of view it was not worth the life of a single American. Regardless of their reasons for opposing the war they fought in, many crippled or mentally scarred, the general public attitude toward dissenting veterans was as traitors from the right and baby killers from the left, though both attitudes would change. As it turned out, the idea among Oregon anti-war groups of doing something about the presence of the American Legion in Portland was seriously thought about throughout the winter and spring 1970. More immediate matters took precedence, however, such as the U.S. invasion of Cambodia and the consequent national student strike in opposition that May, which included Portland State University and the city's SWAT squad police attack on protesters on May 11th, which became known as Bloody Monday. After that, organizing to protest the Legion convention became front burner priority among the myriad variations of Oregon's small counterculture, with the distinct exception of Black activist groups. As a result of my association with VVAW, I was elected titular mouthpiece of the People's Army Jamboree, which was publicly promoted as confronting the Legion. I was not an especially good organizer, but I had talent as a frontman. I made speeches, was interviewed by local and national media. I was allowed semi-equal time on local TV and radio to counter a rather hysterical diatribe by Governor Tom McCall. Yet I also publicly supported the governor's rock festival, Vortex, which was inspired to detour incoming outside agitators from reaching Portland, and also from concern that police did not distinguish pot-smoking music lovers from hardcore political dissenters. With the cultural side of the counterculture removed, the streets of the city were open to the political portion without worry about harm to spaced-out heathens. Articles and newscasts escalated the tension, as did rumors that a hippie army planned to invade and take over Portland, and that residents had bought out the city's stock of oven cleaner to be used in defense against forceful left-wing demonstrators. There were also rumors and substantial evidence that a trap was about to be sprung on us. The city was to be packed with police from all over Oregon and most of the state National Guard. The rest would surround the revelers at Vortex. A U.S. Army unit from Fort Lewis was to be stationed just across the Columbia River in Washington State. A few of us suspected a slaughter, a testing of how much public opinion would be strained by massacring a bunch of dope-smoking, long-haired, usually white, hippies in a far-off, not very important city in the upper left edge of the country. The previous year, police had attacked and killed several Black Panthers in a number of cities with hardly a murmur from the mainstream, known then as the silent majority. The Portland media portrayed the People's Army Jamboree as if it intended to maraud the city like a biker gang. Sympathetic National Guardsmen told us they were being trained in summer camp to attack hippies. Perhaps the sum of these parts did not add up to our paranoia, but we who were paranoid would have been irresponsible to not attempt to prevent the possible disaster we were paranoid about. We few conspirators staged a clandestine operation to keep people out of Portland. We sent messages and made telephone calls to radical groups all over the country, warning them and explaining we didn't desire to attract fatal attention. We also allied ourselves with the efforts to organize Vortex, which would draw off the non-political hippies and suck up out-of-staters on the road for Portland. We told everybody else that this was our demonstration, and we wished to do it by ourselves. In the meantime, we participated in negotiations with the city. We applied for parade permits and argued for the use of a city park for our countercultural encampment. We wanted beautiful Washington Park for our campground, which we visualized as a final romp of flower children among the park's famous roses. We got instead Delta Park, former site of the city of Vanport, which was washed away by a Columbia River flood on Memorial Day 1948. Frank Ivensee was City Parks Commissioner. We all considered him an evil, ambitious man, perhaps our single consensus, whose deceit had caused bloodshed during the spring student strike. Ivensee made headlines resisting our arguments for a park and condemned our plans of protest as traitorous and communist-inspired. He later used media accounts of his stout resistance to hippie disruption and a photo of me as villain in his campaign literature for mayor, which he eventually became after three attempts and was not reelected. So we bickered with the city for most of that summer while dreaming up a demonstration schedule as logistically complex as a military campaign. By the time the American Legion marched into Portland, everything seemed anticlimax. Tensions and fears had been so relentlessly exploited in the weeks and days before their arrival that the event itself was played through at half speed with a large sense of deja vu. We conducted our descent peaceably to the contempt of the national press, which had gathered in Portland and considered our lack of bloodshed the mark of lightweights. A columnist for the Washington Post, Nicholas von Hoffman, wrote, "The People's Army Jamboree is a lot like the Loch Ness Monster. Everybody's talking about it, but nobody has ever seen it." I presented an idea at the final hysteria pitch meeting of the PAJ crowd before Legion Week, which I thought was a radical departure from standard radical practice. A young girl walks through the city's deserted streets. She is about 8 years old. Her hair is long. She wears a dress. She carries a flower in one hand and sign in her other hand. "In the War" is printed in bright paint on the sign, which is a piece of wood nailed to a stake. She walks down the middle of several streets. On each side of every street, against buildings or grouped in open spaces, are armed policemen and state national guardsmen. They watch the girl menacingly. She sings only one song: "We Shall Overcome." The girl would have to be 8 or 9, not much older, or she risked rape. It would be a feast for television, I argued. Just a lone little girl, virginal, anyone's daughter or little sister, marching past the assembled might of the government. Look at the contrast. Focus on the little girl in the empty streets. Close-ups of snarling cops wrapping their palms with nightsticks, National Guardsmen with bayoneted rifles waiting, various forms of paralyzing gases in handheld canisters, newscasters' voices edged with contempt at the uniformed brutes clustered in sinister ambush to molest the little girl, perhaps split-screen the girl with marching American legionnaires. No chance. The crowd wanted to march en masse, do the usual hippie demonstration shtick. After most of a summer spent in tense anticipation and growing public hysteria for our spectacular, no one wished to stay out of whatever action was ahead. Everybody was impatient for the performance to begin. Yet, for all that tense impatience, we were obsolete at the very moment of our presence. The real war was for racial and sexual equality, as well as for economic justice. Our protest of an unpopular war was a brief recess from the more enduring struggles. Everywhere the People's Army Jamboree appeared that week, the Legion was in town. It was ringed with concerned citizens who offered themselves as a buffer between us and the armed forces of law and order. They were a well-publicized group that called itself People for Portland and included nuns and ministers, as well as average everyday folk who were worried about violence between police and hippies, among them a gubernatorial candidate defeated in the state Republican primary the spring of 1994. Encounters with police were mild, which probably disappointed a few on both sides of the People for Portland rings. My own tactics to keep the trigger on safe were to roam among demonstrators and quell outbreaks as they occurred, which usually meant pointing out troublemakers as police provocateurs, some of whom probably were. I didn't care. My intent was to isolate belligerent loudmouths before they caused the police to attack. Fewer of us protested the presence of the American Legion than attended Vortex. The national media were disappointed we did not provide a bloody spectacle, as were several members of law enforcement. Proof of that confrontation was overblown from the beginning. It was apparent when President Nixon, who had planned to make a war speech to the Legion, sent in his place Vice President Spyrokakis T. Agnes, a Greek-American who referred to everybody else as Dagos, fat Japs, etc. Some say Nixon was frightened of being attacked, possibly assassinated. I think he realized the political insignificance of appearing in a substantially diminished public melodrama. The pre-convention display of hysteria had a sobering effect, and in the end, no one wanted to be responsible for the violence that almost everyone feared or claimed to fear. Portland's residents did not wish a reputation for bloody civil war. That determined pressure to avoid violence was powerful enough to prevent it. Half a century later, 2 decades into a brand new millennium, my most lasting impression of the People's Army Jamboree and its countercultural doppelganger, Vortex One, is of Arthur Honeyman, who was born with cerebral palsy, being hoisted on the big shoulders of a large man who had spent 2 years in prison for refusing to be drafted into the Vietnam War. He lifted Arthur above a horde of helmeted and armed police security agents and National Guardsmen that separated we anti-war heretics from the Vice President of the USA, who scurried for a waiting helicopter to whisk him away. Perched on the big man's shoulders, Arthur slowly, spastically lifted his right arm into the air and raised his skinny social finger at Spiro Agnew as defiantly as the Statue of Liberty grasps her torch. And that was the People's Army Jamboree. And now, Oregon World War I vet led to a 20,000-strong bonus army in 1932 that marched on nation's capital by Douglas Perry of the Oregonian. Walter W. Waters called the mass protest a safety valve for disaffection. The Oregon native didn't want revolution or anarchy, but he and millions of other Americans were desperate. So Walters, a laconic 34-year-old who had fought in France during World War I, led a couple of hundred of his fellow former servicemen on a 3,000-mile trek from Portland to Washington, D.C. It was 1932, the depths of the Great Depression. The veterans wanted the federal government to act, and they believed a good place to start would be the immediate cash payment of their World War I service certificates or bonuses. This was the bonus march, and they were the bonus army. The veterans rode in freight train boxcars when they could. They walked along the sides of dusty roads. The movement grew and grew with veterans from all over the country headed for Washington. Around 20,000 men and their families ultimately arrived in Washington, D.C. that summer. They set up camp around a series of unoccupied buildings on Pennsylvania Avenue, as well as along the Anacostia Flats across the river. They met with members of Congress and answered reporters' questions. Concerned about running a budget deficit, the U.S. Senate in mid-July voted down a bill that would have allowed the World War I service certificates, which were redeemable in 1945, to be paid out right away. When news of the vote arrived, observers worried that the veterans massed near the Capitol would try to overrun Congress. Walter Waters, at the head of the crowd, threw his hands in the air. "Sing America," he called out. Some of the men near Waters began to belt out America the Beautiful. The tension of the moment broke and the vets headed back to their camps. But even with this stinging defeat in the Senate, thousands of the bonus marchers stayed in the nation's capital. They refused to accept the vote as the final word on the matter. Finally, after 2 months of looking out from the White House at the veterans, Pennsylvania Avenue shantytown, President Herbert Hoover had had enough. He directed Army Chief of Staff General Douglas MacArthur to disperse the bonus army. MacArthur had no problem with the order. Like Hoover, he believed the vast majority of the bonus marchers were fakes, his biographer William Manchester wrote. That is, he thought they were professional agitators and criminals, not veterans. MacArthur's colleague, Major General Courtney Whitney, later went further, insisting that a secret document which was captured, quote unquote, showed the bonus march to be a communist plot that included plans for the public trial and hanging in front of the Capitol of high government officials. The secret document never existed. It had been invented by the Bonus Army's opponents, and the U.S. Veterans Administration would later determine that some 95% of the marchers were veterans and their families. On July 28th, hundreds of armed infantry and cavalry soldiers and even half a dozen tanks advanced on the veterans, but the marchers stood their ground. They booed, exhorted the soldiers to think about what they were doing, and even physically fought back. Finally, MacArthur unleashed waves of tear gas, forcing the men and their families to flee. In the immediate aftermath, there was talk of Waters becoming a political leader, the voice of the down and out, with some critics calling him a dictator. Nothing came of it. He didn't know what he was going to do next. Ever since returning from the battlefields of France and receiving an honorable discharge as a sergeant, Waters had struggled to find a place in society. He'd worked as a mechanic, a car salesman, and a baker in the 1920s, with none of the vocations sticking. He even tried to take on a new name, Bill Kincaid, in a vain attempt to break more decisively with the past. At last, he latched onto a job he enjoyed at a cannery near Portland. Then the economic cataclysm hit. He lost his position a year after the 1929 stock market crash. Week after week, he could come up with no means to provide for his wife and 2 children. Hopelessness grew in his gut, and bitterness soon followed. While making the rounds every day in search of work, he found that a large percentage of jobless men in Portland were, like myself, ex-servicemen, he later wrote. They had fought, so they had been told a few years before, to save the nation. They had fought, it now seemed, only in order to have a place in which to starve. That was when he came upon the idea, unsuccessfully put forward the previous year by a little-known Texas congressman, of cash payouts of the World War I service certificates. It mattered not that the bonus was not due legally until 1945, Waters wrote. What man, having a promise to be paid at a later date, would not ask his debtor for it in advance if he believed that the debtor could afford the money and if his own need was not only great but critical? These men felt that the government had the money, newspapers, which can always be picked out of trash cans in the parks and public places, published stories of extensions of credit to foreign nations, headlines told of loans to railroads and to large corporations. Waters made this pitch one night in March 1932 at a veterans meeting in Portland, recommending they argue their case in person before Congress. Soon they had made up a banner, Portland Bonus March onto Washington. Then they gave themselves a moniker, the Bonus Expeditionary Force, a nod to the name for the American Army that had sailed to France 15 years earlier. Local reporters picked up on the incipient effort, finding Waters to be both likable and quotable. The story went out on the news wires. Many Americans embraced the veterans as they made their way to Washington from towns and cities across the U.S. Once in the nation's capital, the marchers set up their encampments. Waters, their commander, demanded discipline from his men. No panhandling, no liquor, and no radical talk. But Hoover was not among the sympathetic, and he ultimately won the day. About 1,000 soldiers, led by MacArthur himself on horseback along with his aide, Major Dwight D. Eisenhower and Major George S. Patton, drove the Bonus Army out of the nation's capital on July 28th. Two marchers, both World War I veterans, died that day, shot by local police. A soldier bayoneted a 7-year-old boy who was trying to retrieve his pet rabbit from a tent in one of the camps. MacArthur's men set the Bonus Army's shantytowns ablaze. "The American flag means nothing to me after this," cried one man who witnessed the soldiers' move against the veterans. Waters couldn't believe his own government would turn its military might against him and his brothers. "There was murder done on Black Thursday, July 28th, Waters wrote in his memoir. "The methods of eviction on that day revealed a stupidity and cupidity among Washington politicians that is almost unbelievable." Waters, who would later land a job as a clerk in the War Department and go on to serve in the Navy during World War II, was hardly the only one to think so. Following these events in their local newspapers, many Americans came to view Hoover's decision to direct active duty soldiers against former soldiers as proof of his callousness to the average American's plight during the Depression. Historians widely believe that the Bonus Army confrontation played a key role in Hoover losing his reelection bid later in the year in a landslide to New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt. In the run-up to the election, an editorial in The Nation magazine, citing the Bonus March, criticized Hoover for attempting to make radicalism rather than the economic cataclysm the issue of the day, wrote the magazine. The effort proved to be one of the deadliest boomerangs in political history. And that was Oregon World War I that led 20,000 strong Bonus Army in 1932 by Douglas Perry for the Oregonian newspaper. And this is Michael McCusker. Yesterday's centennial commemoration of women's suffrage might just indicate how tipped the scales are against Donald Trump this November. Remember, despite all his huffing and puffing about voter fraud, he lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million in 2016. He subterfuged the Electoral College, perhaps his first major hoax. So, if Trump refuses to leave the White House after he loses this election, it would be historically, as well as poetically, relevant if a national grassroots progression started in Portland to remove him from the White House and perp walk him to the nearest federal jailhouse. Ironically, almost in response to Barack Obama's plea, "Don't let them take away your democracy," Trump said in his opening tirade at the GOP convention this past Monday, "Don't let them remove me. Stay safe. Don't let them unmask you. Protecting yourself protects everybody else."